Hello and welcome. My name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm the collections coordinator for humanities collections at the MSU libraries. I'm also librarian for English and American literature. I just want to say a few words of thanks to some of our sponsors, and I'll give a short introduction. I'd first like to say thanks to the library's computing and technology programs, under which the library is budgeted and has sponsored all library events, and especially Carol Armstrong. Carol's not here, is she? Carol Armstrong, who has created an endowment for the library's events, so that's how a lot of this gets done. I'd also like to thank Anita Skeen, I know Anita's here, for spreading the word to the center, or to the Residential College people, Residential College in Arts and Humanities, and the Center for Poetry, and the Department of English, who bring us Diane Wachowski. And finally, I'd like to thank Jerry and Diane Rothenberg for coming to MSU for this occasion. This is the Michigan Writers Series, which is a conjoined effort between Special Collections, which houses many first editions, rare copies of books and manuscripts from notable Michigan authors, and the Digital Multimedia Center, who record and stream these events and stream them over the web. Now, this is the Michigan Writers Series, but you'd think that Jerry is Jerome Rothenberg. Diane Wachowski is obviously a Michigan poet, having lived here from the 70s, and just a few years ago been given the Michigan Author Award from the Michigan Library Association. But you might not know that Jerry also has Michigan ties, having received a graduate degree, albeit from the University of Michigan, in the 1950s. So the series title does actually work. I'll just give a short introduction for each of our guest speakers, our readers. I want to say there's books for sale. Diane is reading from her brand new book, The Diamond Dog, and she's brought copies. And Jerry is also traveling around the country with apparently a suitcase full of books, which he also has for sale as well. After the reading, I'm sure they'll be happy to sign books as well. Is that correct? Yeah? Good. Diane Wachowski and Jerome Rothenberg began their careers in poetry together in New York City of the early 1960s, and they share what was the beginning of a school of poetry, along with Robert Kelly, the Deep Imagists, though each has enjoyed a long and studied careers that have taken their writing in other directions. It has been more than 25 years since they have read together in a poetry event. Diane Wachowski's work has been published in more than 20 collections and many slim volumes since her first book, Coins and Coffins, was published by Hawkswell Press in 1962, and Jerry was the publisher, actually. Her book, Emerald Ice, won the Poetry Society of America's William Carlos Williams Prize in 1989. Since 1975, she has been poet in residence at Michigan State University, where she holds the title of University Distinguished Professor. Her new book, The Diamond Dog, is published by Anhinga Press, and we have copies over there. What is it?
Anhinga is a diving bird, a fishing bird.
Oh, okay.
It spreads its wings out.
Jerome Rothenberg Jerome Rothenberg is an internationally known poet, polemicist, translator, and anthologist with over 80 books of poetry and 10 assemblages of traditional and contemporary poetry, including Technicians of the Sacred and Poems for the Millennium. He pioneered the field of ethnopoetics, a combination of poetic practice and anthropological theory, and has been a longtime practitioner and theorist of performance poetry. His forthcoming titles include Gematria?
Yeah, you can Gematria do it. You can do it that way if you want.
Okay.
Hard G.
Okay, Gematria.
Right.
Gematria Complete, Concealments and Caprichos, and Retrievals, Uncollected and New Poems, 1955 to 2010. I think they're going to do a kind of conjoined poetry reading, so Jerry's going to read first. Please welcome Jerome Rothenberg.
Thank you.
Yeah, when you say conjoined, I think if the term is still used of Siamese twins, but we are close, and that's why, for me, I hope for you too, it's a rather special occasion, and the time of our meeting, goes back to 1960, I think.
New Year's Eve, 66.
Which means, Diane, that this is our golden anniversary.
Wow.
Diane had just come from California, from Berkeley, and I had been living most of my life in New York, except for the year spent at the other school, which was interesting. Deep Image was something to which I gave a name, and which we thought about, a kind of neo-surrealism, to tell the truth. And during the early part of our friendship, there are two poems dedicated to Diane Warkoski. One simply by the initials. I don't know why I didn't write out your name for this, for DW. A series of six prose poems called Poems for the Hell of Hungry Ghosts. And that's a Japanese reference, and probably I don't have to go into more detail on it. But it had been part of that concern with things Japanese that came to many of us very strongly in the 1950s, in the post-World War II period. And there's a reference in here to just the word Tenochtitlan, which is the old Aztec capital, now known as Mexico City, but then Tenochtitlan, where strange ceremonies took place. And possibly the largest city in the world at the time of the conquest. Quite extraordinary. Poems for the Hell of Hungry Ghosts for Diane Warkoski. A white rose burns in the center of the garden. What else is there to say? I will stand here coatless and listen to the others talk. Someone complains that he's hungry, but haven't I seen the hungry before? Nothing will concern me tonight. The hungry, the desperate, the mad. What are they beside the charred bones that we leave behind us? Forget them. The black sky still rises over our heads. Two. And the fire dies. The swollen tongue rolls in the mouth. The teeth scrape against each other. A white film rises from the throat. The dying man is on the floor beside us, no longer to be trusted. But wasn't the poison good that we gave him? Eyes throbbing in the withered skull, the whole mind bursting into darkness. What did he ask of you? A little food? Three, Tenochtitlan. The living room is where the ceremony takes place. The chieftain, dressed in the golden skin of his victim, sits by the window and smokes. A clay bowl is on a table in the center. It contains the victim's heart and fingers. A marriage ring glitters in the dish. Lost in thought, the chieftain lifts a knuckle to his lips and waits. The meal takes place in silence. Afterwards, the bones are gathered in a silver box. He brings them to an altar in the foyer. Four, but hell is always present. It is with us in the tree that rises skyward like a sword. We climb it slowly, but the blade is sharp. It cuts our legs, our testicles. A wind blows the thin leaves that strike our hands like razors that slash our eyes and ears. We fall lightly through the darkness where the river waits for us. My mouth fills with vinegar, upstream, downstream. Death is on all sides. Five. Now I was hungry too. When the soldiers pulled me from the river, I threw myself at their feet. I too became a beggar. But what was the good of it? Heating an iron crowbar, which they put to my mouth. They forced my lips apart with it, and they placed a tiny red-hot ball inside me. Down it went, burning my tongue, my throat, my chest, the screaming fire. What would be left of me? Day and night, the same. I write these words from hell. 6. What you are, you cannot escape. The fire may make it a little more clean, but the fire is only a reminder. It is like the voices speaking around me. What are the voices speaking around me? They aren't only the dead or those whom I loved, but they are also those whom I hated and who hated me. Because we couldn't touch each other in the darkness or draw close, and because we stood coatless in the garden and only listened, and because hunger and pain had lost all meaning, we lived for what was not ourselves. But that was its own punishment, of course. And if you tell me there is some greater punishment, I will not believe you. Or if you say there is some greater pain, I will welcome it gladly. So that was one, probably written early 1960s. And then maybe 14 or 15 years later, some notes for a new series of poems to celebrate the American Revolution. 1776 to 1976, but I remember that I actually wrote it before the 200th anniversary of the American Revolution, and with an awareness that Diane McCoskey, in the meantime, had written a series, wonderful series of poems about George Washington. So I got it feeling in a patriotic vein, except there's a lot of royalty that runs through this, and some notes for a new series of poems to celebrate the American Revolution, 1776 to 1976. It's in 9 parts. 1. Before beginning, I have a few things left to do. And before beginning, I have a place to find for being tired. I have some hard work and to stretch my legs. I have persuasion as a last resort. Before beginning, candles. Before beginning, the tired feeling after oratory and the nights after oratory. Before roads which have nothing to do with where they're going. Is someone pleased? A question. I have a question in beginning the count to count the dead. The testimony is wasted effort, likewise music. 2. Retreat. Make love. Build cities. Open baskets. Shovel quick stones. Mark the compass, bathe, be open, find a better place to bathe, run. 3. Every Sicilian is a clown. Every Jew is a manager. Every Negro is catastrophic. Every Irishman is every. Every effort to be framed is dull. Every well is dry. Every promise is a better day. 4. The king was the last to arrive. He had a terrible headache. They gave him aspirin. The taste was hard for him to believe. The water was harder. The goats were locked in the mirror. The more, the merrier. Good morning, neighbors. His breath smells sweet to everybody. Smile for the king. 3. She has written a poem in which there are no bodies but only points of radiant light. I don't know what I was thinking of. She watches the lights move and understands only that her own eyes are moving. She pretends to be the first woman to speak in an uncertain voice. She opens her hands in front of her face and sees the lights falling down. She is ready for snow now that it's over. 6. She is two steps further along the road, but by tomorrow she will just have started. She is not Betsy Ross and has no stars to cut into shapes, but only lights. She is not the first queen to wear silk. She is never a queen herself, but knows the others by a kind of introduction. She is thanked twice, but she fails to respond. 7. She calls herself the mother of your country. She is well proclaimed. The others who are well proclaimed stare at her in wonder. She is seldom there. 8. Empress and tree. Tree and pit. or war, or simply war, or simply watermelons. Each side begins war. Tree and pit, empress and watermelons, and often memories, or war, or simply war, or simply watermelons. 9. They are hurting each other. They are smiling. They are saying they are in love and offer you a place to turn from it. They are the color of ice. They are best cleansing. They are again without speech, and from this they gain power. They survive without blame. They are blameless. Diane.
I should turn this thing on. When Jerry Rothenberg turned 60, which was not in the 60s, but recently, someone put together a fest trip for him and asked many of us who are his friends to write poems for Jerry. So I'm going to begin by reading a poem called El Camino Real, The King's Highway, for Jerry, who now lives in Southern California, where I no longer live. We transform the places we live. So, just beyond my oak tree, here in East Lansing, Michigan, I can hear the ocean of my childhood. Voices like sequins from the jackets of Elvis the King or Liberace floating on these waves. Only now you've multiplied them, Jerry. Frank Mitchell's horse songs can be heard mmming and mmming on the edge of cliffs still lined with purple ice plant. While Stevens did not have more siren voices in his waves than you've added to our Pacific. Satan and Gore, Arshiel Gorky, Gertrude Stein, Tristan Tzara, the tormented from the seven hells of Jigoku Zoshi, as well as your own voice, raised in sorrow and praise for all spirited dead. Right now, I see nothing but the leaves of my yellowing oaks, like gold coins floating on the autumn air, when I look out my window to the rim of this small backyard. But I know you are right out there, right on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, which might be as close as Grove, the next street over. It is there that white sun, black sun cuts each diurnal movement into long-stemmed yellow roses, rustling the tissue of their slim florist box. Just as I drive down my main street in this Midwestern town, whose yellow glowing street lights at night give it the exactness of an Edward Hopper painting, you turn daily off El Camino Real, the glittering bearded highway of the Spanish king, my king of Spain, is an idea, an image of some searching for a life which lasts, not just a mirror life, but one filled with birds of paradise, patio cymbidiums, and paper exquisite winter lettuce. I think to many of us, you have invented the royal image, the power to travel anywhere, explore, the voice which floats on the waves like sequins, the voice which floats down from my oak trees like gold coins, the voice of phosphor floating out of my mind, western streetlights, the voice which is like a pumpkin, full, gold, shaken, radiant with earthy, big-seeded light. Thank you, Jerry. Jerry was alluding to the fact that he coined a term, deep image, that no one really knows what to do with, since we didn't really turn it into anything. But I think it came from the fact that we were all really involved with techniques of surrealism as a very basic response to the possibilities of the New American poetry. And for me, the aspect of deep image that I think is most persistent in my work and has continued over the years is the sense of it as duende and very much in response to Garcia Lorca's poetry, which of course I only read in translation, but which influenced me deeply when I was an undergraduate and gave me a sense of possibility in poetry. And so for being able to connect with Jerry and the other poets of that group gave me a sense that this wasn't just a European phenomenon, something you read in your French 2 class. It was something that we could be doing. And I wasn't entirely sure how to do it, so I thought I'll read next the title poem of my very first little chapbook, my collection, published by Rothenberg's Hawkswell Press in 1962, Coins and Coffins. You all know me and my ideas about personal mythology and the way you take the stories of your life and transform them into stories that may not be so documentary, but in fact are the stories that tell your emotional situation. And so in the 1960s, my life was, it seemed very dark to me, and yet I had a story that I didn't want to tell. And so I buried it in poems like this. Coins and Coffins Under My Bed. Three children dancing around an orange tree, not holding hands because the tree is too round and full, and there are only three of them. The spiders making their webs in the orange tree talk to the children. Do you want silver coins? Do you want silver cups? Do you remember our names? They ask. One little boy answers, I want silver rings. I want silver keys. I remember my own name. It is John. But the spiders are making their webs larger and larger. A yellow spider says, do you hear us spinning? The sound is so loud it makes our legs vibrate. Do you know that David is dead and buried under this tree? Do you want silver coins to buy death away? Do you want silver cups to drink at your wedding? We spin our webs to spell our names, your names, dark names, three children dancing around an orange tree. They are heavy with childhood. We want silver rings to link us together and silver keys to unlock your webs, and we all know your names. They are John. Quietly, under the orange tree, David, who is dead and buried, settles down. The spiders walk over the earth like tightrope walkers, playing above the crowd, and I forget the coffin under my bed. Tell me, spiders, what I want to hear. Why those children, all three of them, sing around this tree. They are heavy with rings. Their bodies are made of bells. And tell me, what are your names, spiders? I will write your names on coins and throw them in the coffin under my bed. Tell me why my hands are empty of rings, yet heaviest of all, and my body, like a bell, doesn't ring. I have thousands of keys, keys on the doorstep, in my ears, under my pillow, in my clock, rooms full of keys, chests full, iron crates full. They unlock everything, and I hate them. Three children around an orange tree, who know the answers to everything. Spiders who know more. Do you see the round orange tree with three children dancing around it? I'm trying to believe I haven't seen, glinting through the leaves, the hanged man caught by his key ring, hanged by the key, and the sun catching it as it swings. I'm going to try to read primarily from my new book, The Diamond Dog, which is so far the last in a whole string of events where I create a mythological person like the King of Spain or a co-opt one like Medea. And the Diamond Dog is this dream image that came to me when I was very young and now is there for reinterpretation. I would like to mention that tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock, if you don't know about the Triple Goddess Bookstore in Okemos, Dawn Coe is here. They're sponsoring a book signing, al fresco, I believe, although I'm not sure that that'll work if it rains. But it's at 5 o'clock tomorrow at the Triple Goddess Bookstore, and I'll be talking and reading and acting silly in general. I'll read one short poem called Sarah's New Wedding Ring Reminds Me I Knew Even Then As a Child The Diamond Would Jump Off My Finger If I Ever Dared to Put It There. It would follow someone else, then return, but not to the band of faith. The ring I have always worn, Saturn's ring, the invisible one you have never seen, is diamondless. The diamond dog, however, that is the fulfillment of my leaping carbon destiny. Jerry? Better take this.
Yeah, we've set ourselves the problem of how to follow each other, and there are any number of things in what you were doing that, you know, that I wanted to pick up on. You know, but just the term, the personal mythology, you know, something in some ways that I've tried to evade over the years, but it's, you know, it's very much there. It's very much there. But it seems to me that personal mythology, you know, as in, you know, certainly the Coins and Coffins poem, you know, merges with, you know, a world of not personal, but you know, the great themes of folklore and myth, you know, that are not just yours or mine, you know, but you know, come from other places, and that we, in the way I understand it, you know, become have our own voice, but also become a conduit for voices that are not our own. I thought because. Since I'm not here all the time, I will, you know, be reading poems from the past, you know, and then hopefully getting around to, you know, poems from the more very present. So this from a series of poems that came together in a book called Poland 1931, an attempt to write an ancestral poetry and. You know, so there are things that are my own and are not my own that come into this, and Poland is specific for me, Jewish Poland, a world apart from, sometimes apart, sometimes overlapping, sometimes identical with the other Poland. So this is the opening of Poland 1931, called the Wedding. Just preliminary to that, I quote Edmund Dahlberg, a great, possibly now forgotten writer from the earlier part of in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And I said, O defiled flock, take a harp and chant to the ancient relics, lest understanding perish. What David Meltzer very kindly called my attempt to write a Jewish surrealist vaudeville. Poland, 1931, the wedding. My mind is stuffed with tablecloths and with rings, but my mind is dreaming of Poland, stuffed with Poland, brought in the imagination to a black wedding, a naked bridegroom hovering above his naked bride. Mad Poland, how terrible thy Jews at weddings, thy synagogues with camphor smells and almonds, thy thermos bottles, thy electric fogs, thy braided armpits, thy underwear alive with roots, oh Poland, 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 Poland. How thy bells wrapped in their flowers toll, how they do offer up their tongues to kiss the moon, old mother, stuck in thy sky, thyself, an old old bell with no tongue, a lost udder. Oh, Poland, thy beer is ever made of rotting bread. Thy silks are linens merely, thy tradesmen dance at weddings where fanatic grooms still dream of bridesmaids, still are screaming past their red mustaches, Poland. We have lain awake in thy soft arms forever. Thy feathers have been balm to us. Thy pillows capture us like sickly wounds and guard us. Let us sail through thy fierce weddings, Poland. Let us tread thy markets where thy sausages grow ripe and full. Let us bite thy peppercorns. Let thy oxen's dung be sugar to thy dying Jews. O Poland, O sweet, resourceful, restless Poland, O Poland of the saints, unbuttoned Poland, repeating endlessly the triple names of Mary. Poland, 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 Poland. Have we not tired of thee, Poland? No, for thy cheeses shall never tire us, nor the honey of thy goats. Thy grooms shall work ferociously upon their looming brides, shall bring forth executioners, shall stand like kings inside thy doorways, shall throw their arms around thy lintels, Poland, and begin to crow.
And this, called Esther Kay Comes to America, 1931. In the title, Poland, 1931 is the year of my birth, not in Poland, but in Brooklyn. My mother's name was Esther. That's personal mythology. It was also said that the Jewish queen of the Polish Emperor Casimir I was named Esther, and the diminutive of Esther in Polish is Esterka, so Esther K. And then there's Kafka's Joseph K. So you know all of that in the title, the rest is. Whatever it is. But Esther Kay Comes to America, 1931. The wilderness, but otherwise name of a cafeteria where the two lovers drink tea, not speaking to each other, but sharing a world through separation. 1931, Esther Kay and Leo Levy have met here at the end of a short life. Nothing begins as painfully as the first step outside the glass door, the first sight of traffic, even the rumblings of the new subway under Houston Street. All this happened in the course of ages. The priest tormented her, and that was one. The governor broke into sighs, and that was another. Her mother became incontinent, and that was the third. Other events followed. Fourth was the birth of a child dead at childbirth. She massaged its hands, but had to suck her own breasts. Stale odors. Leo Levy, going every morning to the chicken market, pursues his dream of power. Esther Kay wonders, how was I ever trapped inside this body? In another life, she would have been a playgirl. Not she, but someone else threw roses in the Dnieper, danced on the drifting ice flow to America. Not someone else, but she opened the fly of the Shanghai dog merchant and greased his cock. Flesh erupting in the tropics, bewildering parrots bathed in the mind of Esther Kay. The traveler who crossed the Ganges found Harlem on the other side. The man with six fingers on one hand had four on the other. Thus, history repeated itself with marked rapidity, leading her to first meet and then lose Leo Levy, leading him to polish his fingernails with egg white, leading them both to read fortunes in earwax, to sell candy in Turkish baths and cotton in Canada, to remake 1931 as a talking movie. What lovely dreams the world will have of Esther Kay, said Leo Levy. I will make dreams for the world to have of Esther Kay and garments to wear in her image. I will comb her hair out until it reaches to Nicaragua, then will climb its length and let it carry me to the top of a windy boat sailing for Jerusalem. Farewell. The next price of almonds is a fair price. The poor under your window and the poor around your table will always be there. The bicyclists will too, but pedaling backwards, stumbling against churches, they will pretend to drop behind. A crisis, the good life of the timid beckons. It is a value to be learned, a source of fortune, only too distant without refinement. Both will grow sick and die much later. Separate beds wait for them, chimeras dressed as chorus girls to direct and love. His name changed to Ben Messiah, hers to his, an aged couple, smelling of wet sheets. They will sometimes be holding hands, feeling how small the palms are. The wilderness has shrunk them. Tomorrow morning was a lie, a glass of tea, maybe a bun with onions, a suck, two bitter almonds, three half-chewed jelly slices, a lemon, a lemon, a lemon, a lemon, a lemon, a lemon, a lemon.
Since you alluded to the George Washington poems, and you've just read a poem about your mother, maybe we could read a poem about father of my country,
yes.
George, from the past. George Washington writes home about harvesting his hemp. I won't take a lot of shit in the name of love, smoking it or eating it or shoveling it for you. You write a letter to Martha telling her how much you miss her, sitting at home, tight as a cable, managing your house, how you long to be there when the plants are harvested, the special crops you spent long hours reading the seed catalog about makes especially fine, thick, resinous fibers, said the book. So juicy at harvest time, you smell the medicine in the air. And so you make special plans to be there when the hemp is harvested. Your dreams take the form of women, lying down, taking off their clothes on American flags, serving you in the name of your country, the soft aroma of Virginia hemp curling around your nose like a cat rubbing at the cook's legs while she's making dinner. My first statement is true about you and me. The plants are ready to be harvested, the hemp sticky with brown dust as a caterpillar, and you, nostalgic, away from your plantation, coming home in letters to remind us of your deep commitments there. But I'll let all that hemp die. The ropes it will make mean nothing to me but nooses. I will not take any more shit in the name of love, not smoke it or eat it or clean it up for you. That was my voice of the 60s. And maybe this is the voice of 21st century, from the Diamond Dog. The title of this poem is a quotation from a really interesting new book that's just been published. I read this chapter of it in a literary magazine. It's a book by somebody named Zachary Mason called The Lost Books of the Odyssey. And in it, he purports that Odysseus comes home and doesn't see anything like, so he goes back on his travels. He has more adventures. And of course, all of this material has so many different versions that, you know, we only know one version of the Odyssey. The phrase that Zachary Mason used is black ships drawn up on a white beach. I couldn't resist that. Such an image. And a few years ago, my husband Robert and I went to Northern California and visited my high school boyfriend, the man who probably is the beginning of the betrayer figures in my poems. And it was the first time I'd seen him since, you know, I was 21 or something. And in order to make this a doable experience, we decided
he lives in Northern California, to get some takeout sandwiches and sit on the seawall where we could watch the surfers in the ocean, and very much a scene from our Southern California adolescence. And so this poem comes out of that image of John and me and Robert sitting there on this seawall. That area is right next to Robinson Jeffers' country. Jeffers has been a great inspiration to me, and so there's a reference to that in there. Take me there, oh, take me there, to the seawall in Robinson Jeffers' country. We were like cypress, wind silhouetted on the rocky coast, like ships whose green is almost black, not like an old man and an old woman, though bending away from the wind like those Monterey evergreens. I was watching surfers, not black ships. The long beach was white, and farther down the coast was the poet's stone tower. Now that I am not on that coastline anymore, looking out the window has assumed such importance, as if I were in a tower like Rapunzel, yet no length of braid could any longer draw you up, you who are never the same person. I'd like to send a letter to the King of Spain, the man who remains constant because he is from a fairy tale. I want to tell him about the diamond dog who followed my father out of my life, how the dog runs away every time I call him. Angela tells me there is a white dwarf star with a core of diamond 2,500 square miles in diameter. It is located in the constellation Centaurus and is 50 light years from Earth. She says the cosmic gem is the remains of a star that was once much like our sun. How lucky to have a father who sailed away rather than one who was a disappointment in the flesh. There is great drama possible when lies are told, for the everyday need not intervene its dull self. Living dogs slather, smell fuggish, shed hair, jump on clean clothes or furniture with muddy paws, lick your face, sniff your crotch, but a diamond dog is a little piece of crystalline motion running like a starship, white on the black beach. Odysseus, the father, returned after 20 years of sailing, had sailor's eyes, and saw everything. But he would not have recognized the diamond dog when it greeted his return. Argos, he called it, a premonition. Oh, take me there. Take me to the star in the horseman constellation, whose core is miles of diamond. There I'd be able to see the black ships drawn up on the white beach, drawn close to me. I, lingering on this seawall, they not furling sails or running away.
Well, that's lightweight.
In 1968, I published a book called Technicians of the Sacred, which I know that a number of you know. It was 1968 was, you know, also one of those years that marks a significant part of the century, as 1848 did the 19th century. You know, as 2001 possibly has that kind of significance for us. So that was 40 years ago, and about that time, Diane and I and our son went to visit and then to live on the Seneca Indian Allegheny Reservation in western New York State. And so I want to read the longish opening poem for that, with the little piece that sort of introduces what was going on for us, and all connected to technicians of the sacred, what I was doing there, what was going on in the world, and simultaneously, it was while we were visiting the Seneca Reservation that I began finished working on Poland 1931. So all these things come together in a funny way. And actually, this is short. We lived in a town called Salamanca, Spanish name. On the Seneca Reservation, named for the Duke of Salamanca, who was one of the sponsors of the Erie Railroad. When was it, Diane? 1830s, 1840s. Came to visit, and the town changed its name. The town, which was sitting on the Indian reservation, not exactly an Indian town, but sitting on the Indian reservation, changed its name from the perfectly respectable Bucktooth to Salamanca. I became a beaver in 1968. Richard Johnny John was my father. The ceremony took place in the longhouse and was very brief. They said some words in Seneca. I got a new name. I didn't know if they were serious, but the name was great. Talk to me later and I'll tell you what the name is. My wife and son became blue herons. She was called the one who travels. He was called the talker. My wife's sister was Thelma Ledson, and her mother was Effie Johnson. I got interested in beavers 4 years later when we went to live in Salamanca. Salamanca is a railroad town right on the reservation. I saw it once on a German map of America that omitted Albany. The population is now 7,000 and is mostly white. Charles Olson wrote, "History is the new localism." And Ezra Pound, an epic is a poem including history. When I die, my name goes back to where it came from. A Seneca will come for it. Seneca Journal 1, a poem of beavers for Gary Gordon. In dream, the beavers come to Harry Watt, a child. Could speak, communication. We're standing in a row, they said I would not harm them, would not ever, after hunted mink and badger, but the beavers were my friends and helped me. So his story began and I knew it, also hearing what he said, hearing I knew it, was with me from before my time, and knew it as a memory of my own grandfathers, not as hunters in the woods, but on the edge of old world forests, men and women walked by on the way to markets, public baths, went burying in summer, chased by wolves in winter, past the huts where mushrooms hung to dry, the old women of the woods lived, heavy in gray dresses, chin hairs bristling into Gentile beards, their own familiar dogs and cats beside them, had the master of the good name learned from these the speech of animals. This is the secret all men have retained, that greater language of what biological fellowhood will open to us once again. Ethology. For you bio majors. Ethology, the visions of Michael McClure, and Chomsky, all the speakers of deep tongues point a route this generation will be privileged to assume, a universal speech in which the kingdoms of the world are one. The kingdoms of the world are one. The master of the good name was the founder of Hasidic Judaism in the 17th century. Like St. Francis goes into the woods and learns the language of, I don't know if that's carried over in the ongoing tradition, but learns the language of animals and birds. What is it to be a beaver, truly? When I think of it, I think of water, water on a body, holy hair. I think of beaver hats and beaver movies. I think of a new birth into beaver life.
The beaver in the poem of the Baal Shem is being born. He is the generative part of man, the cock in hair, that low intelligence erupting, changes what we are, the soft becoming hard, the cold one hot, red tongue of beaver in a nest of fur, by a sudden metamorphosis, a fluid world becoming anything the mind can think, the mind is thinking, entering the fluid bottom stream of sex transformed, the Baal Shem leaves the light of Torah and becomes any old animal inside the sacred wood. And I am now living in a place called Bucktooth once, its Indian name, the name of a small man, the book says. He was only 4 feet tall and had a single tooth. They found his skeleton, a single tooth that fell out when they crossed the Allegheny. Belt buckle bore his mark. The grandsons made a coffin. They buried him back where his fathers were. And only 4 feet tall. He must have been one of them little fellows, pygmies of this place, or leprechauns who own the dark dance. No self-respecting Indian would be that small, or say that by that tooth he was a beaver. I would call old beaver tooth, being myself a beaver by adoption, as my wife and child are herons, also by adoption. We adopt these titles. We go home with them. What is this membership we have adopted, grinning in the mirror? My face is changing to a mask. Floyd John once showed me had a single tooth. If I could make my face a mask, I'd be old Bucktooth. Beaver, once again old founder of a town we all can live in, hoping that no other Duke of Salamanca comes to sponsor a new railroad. Beavers and blue heron can't live near, but hide from in the silence of some lousy cave. Not a sweet beast, he is power. Not a sweet man, he is like a muscle titan waiting to crack down and break a skull, maybe splintering the jaw and making the teeth like his own and almost non-existent row, the ghost tooth in the center, shining as a mirror. We can see ourselves down to the farthest tunnel, winding among shining leaves and flowers, words and tiny melodies the colors make. Or if a dream begins with silence in the foot itself, that silence stirs. It is a dance vibrating. Its center of each isolated nerve reminds him of the song he wants to sing when dying. And if the beaver sings it to him now, it means an easy death. Just as the birth was easy, beaver life began in water, was a pound of bones and fur, sure instinct to the mark, sent out his tongue into the left rear nipples, sucked sweet, yellow, sticky milk his mutter gave him. Slurp, says old Bucktooth beaver. Now I must try a swim around. He's only an hour old and talking, swimming, paddling around her tits in noonday sun reclining. Top of the lodge will learn not to let tail get dry, but dribble sweet clarifying smell from nether hole. All creatures hanker for a whiff of, smears it on his hands and dabs the fur. So comfortable and sweet. This is the beaver's life, says old man beaver. Think I might chew a little wood. Just loves to chew and fart. Pleasures are simple. In this world, the trick's to find a tree and let the sun flash on my orange tooth. Tree chips fly all day, and I will stop never until the tree shall come to earth, and never stop, though it may crush me. The film across my eye shall turn to fog. Old ones call dying. But not without a fight, says beaver. Otter stalks him, most cunning, raids my tunnels, kicks in my sweetened mud patties, steaming, still hot with my fragrance, stuffs oil drops and stones up his rectum, cries, me, King Otter, lick me. The great mask of otter filling beaver man's dreams makes tracks in his corn mush, pearly grains of hominy. Under the otter's claws, otter piss splatters his corn soup, sands, soft waves of nausea across my cerebellum, Moe's sly dance of otters on harvest nights, full moon suspended atop an alder pole, delights old beaver man, gathers descendants around him. He stands on the water, slaps it hard with his tail, says, old enemy,
otter in the name of Longhouse the Great, rabbinical council of elders, mystical mammals, the long beards of Zion, America. I have lived my last under the earth. Into a new sun I skitter. Tribal triumphant, says Beaver. I chew off your balls. I survives. And it ends with a kind of translation. Old Man Beaver's blessing song. All I want's a good 5-cent cigar. Hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho. All I want's a good 5-cent cigar. Hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho. All I want's a good 5-cent cigar. Hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho. All I want, a good 5-cent cigar. Hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho. All I want, a good 5-cent cigar. Hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho. All I want. Good 5-cent cigar. Hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho, hee hee ho ho. Old Man Beaver's blessing song.
I can't resist. Mm-hmm. Under my elbow, in my elbow, under my bed, in my bed, under my foot, in my foot, under my eye, in my eye. Yes, yes, I've found it. The lost key, 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 key. What bird sings that song? Key, key. A bird made out of keys, flying to unlock the sun, let out the heat. Flying to unlock the moon and let out the milk. Flying to unravel the mountain and resting on a branch saying, key, key. For me, the story of Medea came alive when I was a sophomore in high school, and my wonderful English teacher played a recording of Judith Anderson performing Robinson Jeffers' version of Euripides' play. And even then, I knew that somehow it had something to do with me. So Medea moves in and out of my poems, and this one from the new book is called The Argonaut Rose, Fleeing with the Diamond Dog, Leaving the Body of Her Brother Absyrtus Behind. I call Medea the Argonaut Rose in one of my other books for many obvious reasons. And those of you who know the story know that she had to sacrifice her brother and let Jason murder him in order for them to steal the golden fleece and escape. In the Argonautica, Apollonius Rhodius describes the sorceress Circe, who is there to cleanse Medea ritually from this terrible betrayal that she has committed in the name of love. And the text in Seton's translation is, she, Circe, longed to hear the voice of the maiden, her kinswoman Medea, as soon as she saw she had raised her eyes from the ground. For all those of the race of Helios were plain to discern, since by the far flashing of their eyes, they shot in front of them a gleam as of gold. He, Jason, never saw, wearing his gold-clad helmet and bearing under his arm the stolen chest now filled with a fleece, that she, this woman of moonlight, this sorceress who had made him royal with her potions of henbane and lily root elixirs that made a dragon sleep. No, he never saw that she, accompanied by her diamond dog, was a princess, and he only an adventurer, perhaps bathed in his wreath of golden decisions, shimmering as he rowed his ship in the arms of Apollo's furled musings. Perhaps he felt manly for taking her back with him, for not abandoning her after she helped him murder her brother Apsyrtus so the Argonauts could escape. And perhaps he even admired her silver body under the mantle of dawn, after making love on the ocean that widened her against her own people. Or perhaps he was really in love with his own golden heroic self, or the other men seated on the Dodonian oak who helped him on this quest. Perhaps she was too quiet, like dawn itself, her magic always invisible, like rain before it pours, or fog as it wraps a man in its frothy sheepskin, thus so powerful, but not something he could remember. Her silver melts into the earth or is outshone in daylight, overshadowed in the silver-pricked night. She gave him his right to radiance, then stepped aside. But he never saw, never noticed, as she floated in her invisible silver raiment, that she had the eyes to match his helmet. For she kept her eyes down, as did modest women, and only Circe, cleansing her from the sacrificial murder of her brother, made her raise them and understood their full sun-dazed intent. I sometimes wonder where all my anger went. Definitely under. And this poem, I think, is indicative of that, if I can find it. Sorry about that. Try the index. This is called On Leonard Cohen's Greek Island. I don't know about you, Jerry, but I hated Leonard Cohen so much because he got so famous, and I thought, oh, he's just a crappy songwriter and not really a poet, although I think that kind of he's come out ahead of things, and and I still remember, you know, his song. One of my bad husbands and I spent a summer on an island in Greece that was where Leonard Cohen was living, and probably where he wrote that song about Suzanne. On Leonard Cohen's Greek Island, where he sang to Suzanne about tea and oranges, where I lived with the dancing bull from Ariadne's labyrinth, where the thread broke and I remained lost, where sailors danced with each other at night in the taverna, their diamond dogs following them back to ships at dawn. I became a maenad. There the beauty was inanimate and hung in summer air like bedsheets wet on line, sodden, too heavy to stir. And there I tossed every night in the damp sheets of beauty's bed, and never dreamed of what flesh I might ritually dismember, minotaur or dancing sailor. Like beauty, I was inanimate, never found the rush, the ecstasy, and never tore apart, despite my anger, what I desired. Thank you.
So many books. Yeah, I'll try a short set, and, you know, then maybe we have room for a couple of others, a couple of other poems to conclude it. So this, because the question of performance came in, I'll do a short Seneca Indian poem, which I'm doing also because it's a poem, a song, without words. This becomes a kind of prototype for one experiment in 20th and maybe into 21st century poetry with sound poetry, poetry without words, go on from there. The composition of this is Avery Jimerson, Seneca Indian singer, for a couple of years I sat in with the Seneca Indian Singing Society. You know, not becoming a Seneca Indian, but you know, being allowed to join in, which was a great privilege. This is one of the songs that we sang for. So it's a women's dance song. I must say at that point, the men played and the women danced, and then the men danced. And now the women have become singers also. Yo, they na yo, yo, they na yo, hi, yo, na yo, 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 they na yo, hey, guy, and away, ah, hey, ah, yo, they na yo, yo, they na yo, hi, yo, na yo, 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 they na yo, hey, guy, and away, ah, hey, ah, yo, they na yo, yo, they na yo. Yo, na yo, 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 hey, yo, 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 hey, you call the spirits, but will they come? Yes. The timing was impeccable. There's nothing left to say. I'm going to read two poems from a series of poems. You know, I'm afraid this also goes back. I'm not going to get to the present. There's a lot in the present, but, you know, but we're... You know, we're doing Auld Lang Syne here. From a series of poems called That Dada Strain. The title is actually American Blues, African American Blues from the 1920s. But Dada, of course, is the great art, anti-art. Movement of also the 1920s, but I don't think the Dada in that Dada strain, you know, refers to Dada in Zurich, Switzerland, Paris, and Hanover, and Berlin, and other places. But they had more than a little in common. So, you know, so sound poetry, you know, American Indian wordless poetry, scat singing, you know, it's all kinds of discoveries. That Dada strain, I'll read a short poem. I sometimes perform this with a kind of musical instrument that I don't have with me because I lost it. Somewhere between Diane Wakonski's house and here, it disappeared on me. But that's okay. I'll do a short poem and then a sound poem by the Dada poet mystic Hugo Ball. That he performed in a costume, which I will briefly describe, in the Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich, June 23rd, 1916. Shortly after left Dada,
went into the mountains of Switzerland, wrote mystical books, and died there as a kind of Catholic Dada saint.
That Dada strain, the zigzag, mothers of the gods of science, the lunatic fixed stars and pharmacies, fathers who left the tents of anarchism unguarded, the arctic bones strung out on Saint Germain like tom-toms, living light bulbs, aphrodisia. Art is junk, the urinal says. Dig a hole and swim in it. A message from the grim computer. Ye are hamburgers.
For that evening's reading, he had made himself a special costume. His legs were in a shiny blue cylinder which came up to his hips so that he looked like an obelisk. Over it, he wore a huge coat collar cut out of cardboard, scarlet on the inside, gold on the outside. It was fastened at the neck in such a way that he could give the impression of wing-like movement by raising and lowering his elbows. He also wore a high blue and white striped witch doctor's hat.
Caravana! Yolifanto Bambla! Oh, Fali Bambla, go sit mpa abla orem, egiga goramen, eco bloiko rusula huyu, hulaka hulala, and lago bung, blago bung, blago bung, buso fataka. Shampa, vula, vusa, olobo, tata gorem, eshiga, tsumbada, vulubu, subudu, ulu, subudu, tumba, ba, umf, kusa, gauma, ba. A glass tube ecstasy for Hugo Ball. A glass tube for my leg, says Hugo Ball. My hat a cylinder in blue and white. The night, the German ostriches, the sink he pisses in. All these become his world. His Dada song, begun there, holds the image until it comes at us. The image from its cross looks down. A ribbon, a revolver, mud. These contribute to his death also, what his death, to what his death contributes later, too hysterical, too sick with God and time. A carousel, a roasted poet, fish, the queen says to his mind and enters where the street of mirrors starts. She sees his face reflected in hunger of the world as pain, the consciousness of death, not why we die, but why we dream about it and why our dreams can't save the dying remnant. Hugo, as I write this poem, the voice cries from a further room, the dancer, singer calls me. From a further room, I step into an obelisk. Below the waist, my mouth opens to sing, but freezes shut in grief for you. Umbula, take, pitli, soluncola, the collapse of language. Tabla, takta, takta, takabala, takatak. A glass tube ecstasy escapes from time. Babula umbalam, the image and the word over your bed hang crucified. Again, the cabaret explodes. Again, again, fatigue. 1 foot in glass, a glass nerve, and a priestly gas pump pulls her hair out.
Well, I think the only poem in the Diamond Dog that's sort of in the spirit of the Dada is this poem, The Bolt of Smoke, while listening to Marilyn Hacker read her poems. So I'm going to read this and then maybe you can
do a nice roundup finale. I have to say that I went to the AWP conference last week to Denver, and people kept saying, oh, how do you like the AWP conference? And I finally kept saying, being at the AWP is like sitting on barbed wire. I have to say that Robert made the only really smart response to that. He said, you mean like a bird? I said, no, definitely not. Moving. And what I want to say is that one of the pleasures of the poetry life that Jerry and Diane Rothenberg and I shared in the 60s was this sense of a community where you were invested in the other people who were writing. So when you were listening to them, you were really interested in what they were saying, writing. You get some of that experience in a poetry writing workshop, especially if the chemistry is good and you really get interested in the other people in the class. And one of the great bankruptcies of our literary time is that very few people have that experience at poetry readings anymore. You're either sitting there, as I was almost always at the AWP, wishing you were up there giving a reading instead of that awful person who gets much more attention and prizes and reviews than you do, or you really admire them, as I do, Marilyn Hacker, but you're very tired from listening to a lot of poetry, and I almost always sit and take, I don't know, write things down. And when I was writing things to keep awake, actually, at Marilyn's reading a couple of years ago, in order to entertain myself, I imagined that a bolt of smoke was coming out of her mouth, out into the audience, and wrapping around me and turning into a Black Panther. And that made me feel connected. And then when I went back to think about this when I was going to write a poem, I had in my notes that she'd been talking about Montaigne. And so I looked up Montaigne in the Columbia Encyclopedia and found out about his very, very famous phrase, que sais-je, what do I know? So, the bolt of smoke while listening to Marilyn Hacker read her poems.
That's a very smart thing.
It is true, awful, and incomprehensible that this bolt of smoke and drapery shoulders the burden of Montaigne tonight. Let me remind you that he was the 16th century essayist whose, quote, rambling collections of personal observations mirror charmingly the author's egocentric and gently skeptical views succinctly expressed in his phrase, que sais-je, what do I know? In retrospect, the bolt of smoke looked like an inky panther padding along the aisle until it rose in the air and curled over to me where it wrapped itself around my red-eared and rubber-stamped mind, its torpid drapery surrounding me as Marilyn, who lives in Paris part of the year, rambled in her fawn-like voice somewhat charmingly. Farsi and Urdu flew from rich and bolted lines curling out of her mouth. I thought of how often I had been rejected by the Paris Review. Surely rejections must be curt, even when they are voluble. The last word, whoever gets the last word. I used to feel rage when I was rejected, but now I let the panther curl its bolt of smoke around me. Possibly Marilyn never feels rage, though what do I know, que sais-je? Not even if sausages are donated to a library in Bombay when she wants them to go to the Chateau de Montaigne in Perigord? How could they when she had planned differently? Yes, she must feel rage, unless she is perfect. Is it hubris to think someone else is perfect and thus equal to the gods? Then will a bolt of smoke come down and smite me? Wait, Is this why people go to poetry readings? So that a bolt of smoke disguised as an onyx dark panther will come and curl around them, making them think inspired talk, whether it be of Montaigne or the wives of quantum physicists, visions from a sweat lodge, or eating crisp tins sounding like particles of charm. Que sais-je, says Marilyn. Thank God for this bolt of smoke wrapped like a feline shawl around me. Perhaps Montaigne would have demanded his own bolt of smoke, que sais-je, or Jack Spicer, though perhaps Marilyn would not have, que sais-je. My mind is not wandering, rather it's just that my imagination is always peopled with the motorcycle betrayer, or the diamond dog, or George Washington. Neither ever should have known about smoke or a panther wrapped around my shoulders if they hadn't been inadvertently listening, as was I, to Marilyn Hacker give a poetry reading when we were all very tired and not even surprised when we saw that bolt of smoke come out of her mouth, just like a line from Montaigne. Que sais-je?
How to wrap this up? Well, I think I'll jump to some more recent work. One of the books coming out is called Concealments and Caprichos, and it really consists of two books, a book of concealments, and another one called 50 Caprichos after Goya. And but I'm going to stay pretty much inside the 21st century, but I'm going to back up to a previous book called A Book of Witness. 100 poems, the first 50 written in 1999, the second 50 written in 2000, so a century of poems at the end of the century. A book of witness, because in it I'm trying to use as much as possible the first-person voice, I, overdoing it rather than suppressing it. All of that is possibly unnecessary to say, but there it is. So it's a book of witness. The last poem written in the 20th century, poem 50 in the sequence, and the first poem written in the 21st century. And the poem in the 21st century written on January 1st, 2000, which some of us mark as the beginning of the 21st century, while some others do not mark it as the beginning of the 21st century. In Southern California, which is a different kind of New Year's Day than where I had grown up, or where we are now, warm, sunny day, you know, and it was no longer a year beginning with the number one. There's a strangeness, and we had been watching futuristic movies on television the night before. The poems also quote a number of first-person statements by contemporary poets who are contemporaries of mine. So in poem number 50, the last poem of the 20th century, it begins with a short sentence by Amiri Baraka, and somewhere in the poem is an equally short sentence from Jenny Holzer. The 51st poem is all my own. I can't say who I am. I can't say who I am, but go for it and speak as if I knew it. Time is half the story, so is death. I run from shadows to avoid old people maddened by God. I follow animals whose eyes at night mirror my face.
Seeing myself asleep, I touch my arm. I celebrate new forms of sex. I am frantic, knowing that nobody has a way out or a face more marked than mine. I was not born live. The case for memory grows weaker day by day. The more I know myself, the less I am. I hold on to a name because it suits me, but the voice behind it never was my own. I come into the new world. Voices are dumb until I speak for them. Knowing the sound, I find myself between two fires. One is dark green, one the color of my mind asleep. I come into the new world where the thought of death no longer rankles. It will be good to be a stranger always, to know the terms by which we visit back and forth and sideways. In the morning, I will wear a suit with shoulders big as boards. My clothes are silver plastic. When I step into the car, it starts to fly. I play games with children where I make a nose into an ear. Like a clock, my heart moves closer to the burning babe and stays there. I will now count the century by ones and twos. This morning, all the voices in my dream spoke with one voice. I feel privileged to be here among you. From now on, we will live on borrowed time. And I'll read the from the 50 Caprichos after Goya, the opening poem and the closing poem to that. And some of that turns up already in things that you were talking about, the duende. The duende, which Lorca saw as the great power force in poetry, also in more folkloric terms, hobgoblin, leprechaun, a strange figure in the way Goya handles it sometimes, comical, or the way I handle it, but... The opening poem is dedicated to Clayton Eshelman, and the titling for these wonderful, fantastic prints of Goya's, are probably his, maybe not, but this is actually written. There's writing within the print itself, and maybe a self-portrait of Goya, because otherwise he does not bring his portrait into the images. Words imprinted, the sleep of reason is the name of the poem. Words imprinted on a sign by Goya, glowing white against a surface nearly white, the sleep of reason that produces monsters. He is sitting on a chair, his head slumped, resting on his arms or on the marble table, pencil set aside, his nightcoat open, thighs exposed. All things that fly at night fly past him, wings that brush an ear concealed, a memory beginning in the house of sleep. His is a world where owls live in palm trees, where a shadow in the sky is like a magpie. White and black are colors only in the mind. The cat you didn't murder springs to life, a whistle whirling in a cup, gone and foregone, a chasm bright with eyes. There is a cave in Spain, a fecal underworld where bats are swarming among bulls, the blackness ending in a wall his hands rub up against. A blind man in a painted world, a mock and monstrous banging on a rock. And the concluding poem, Coda, with duendes. Duendes sound a last hurrah. They squeeze a bellows, scrub a dish with greasy hands, and whisper in an ear bent down to listen. No one sees them. Over every duende falls the shadow of a greater duende. Holy moly, is this not a black sound, Mr. Lorca? Pissing olive oil, I isn't what I seems to be a poor partaker, barrel overturned, the wine eye swigs gone rancid. There is now an end to everything. What is flesh, they suck no more. They drive the foul caprichos out of sight. Caprichos, Goya, Lorca, all my duendes, locked into a cage at dawn, evading sleep and dreams, those whom they leave behind them, fathers raising arms to heaven, screaming through their empty mouths like caverns, black holes where all light is lost. Now is the time.
Thank you.